It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in this week for Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the show, we'll talk with a guest who says the federal government should partner with public universities and colleges to make the first 2 years of higher education free.
First, we're looking up to the skies with an editor at Astronomy Magazine. There's lots of exciting stuff happening in space this month and throughout the rest of the spring. One of those things happened last night. Maybe you saw it, the Blood Moon.
That's a lunar eclipse that makes the moon appear orange or red. Rich Talcott is here to let us know what we should stargaze for next. He's a senior editor at Astronomy Magazine. Rich, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Let's start with last night's lunar eclipse, what people have been calling the blood moon. This type of lunar eclipse, is it rare, and why did we anticipate this one so much?
Well, the reason that we were excited about it is because we haven't had a total lunar eclipse in quite a while. The last one was in December 2011, so it's been more than 2 years since anyone on Earth actually has had a chance to see the moon pass through Earth's shadow. So it was exciting for that reason. It was also pretty cool because the weather around here was clear, which was a surprise after the weather we'd had the last couple of days. But we got to see a good view of it, and it turned out the moon was, I would say, more orangey than blood red last night. I think the name Blood Moon is probably a little bit of a misnomer. It doesn't usually turn that deep of a red color, but it's usually more orangey to maybe brick red.
Mm-hmm. Definitely dramatic, though, isn't it, to think about a blood moon? Have there been examples where the moon really has been a bright red?
Yeah, it does happen occasionally. Probably, I'm guessing maybe like 10% of the time during a total eclipse, it'll turn a color that's fairly close to blood anyway. But last night wasn't one of those cases.
And what makes that happen?
What we're seeing is actually the light from the sun that's passing through Earth's atmosphere. And Earth's atmosphere bends the rays of sunlight through our atmosphere so that it hits the moon. And if listeners will think about what they see when at sunrise or sunset, that the sun tends to turn orangey or red, that's because the light's passing through a lot of Earth's atmosphere. And during an eclipse, the light actually has to pass through about twice as much atmosphere as what you see at sunrise or sunset. So it turns a very deep shade of orange toward red, all the light that's hitting on the moon.
And there's another eclipse that's expected later on this month, isn't it?
You're right, there is. Unfortunately, it's not going to be visible around here.
Oh, okay.
It's a solar eclipse, and usually solar eclipses and lunar eclipses occur about 2 weeks apart. And 2 weeks from today, there's an eclipse down in the southern hemisphere that people in Australia and the lucky ones that live in Antarctica can see, but nothing for us up here.
How common is that for these eclipses to kind of bump up against each other, at least in terms of the time of the year?
It usually happens, actually, that you'll see a solar and a lunar eclipse 2 weeks apart, and then after that sequence, it'll be another 6 months before we see another eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
And the good news for us is that we will see another lunar eclipse coming up in October, and it'll be a total eclipse as well, so it should give us a good view. And there'll also be a solar eclipse that's visible at that time. It'll be a partial eclipse, so not as spectacular as a total one, but it'll still be kind of fun to watch.
Nice. And, you know, I poked my head out the window last night at about 2:15 in the morning, and I saw the moon out there. It was a nice tinge of orange. And then I saw two bright stars, but I'm sure there were planets, right nearby it. What was I seeing out there?
Well, actually, the one that looked orange, probably to the upper right of the moon, was the planet Mars, which is right now about at its closest to Earth that it's been since 2007. So it's shining really bright. Not as bright as the moon, obviously, but mm-hmm. It's pretty spectacular right now, particularly if people would look at it through a telescope. The other somewhat fainter object that was just down and to the right of the moon is the star Spica, which is the brightest star in the constellation Virgo. So that was kind of a neat experience to have those two bright objects so near the moon at the time.
The star Spica, I've never heard of that. What do we know about this particular star?
Well, it actually is pretty hot star, much hotter than the sun, and because of that it has a bluish tinge to it. Now, it's a little bit hard to tell last night because of the moon being nearby, but if you looked carefully or through binoculars, you could probably pick up a slight bluish tinge, so it contrasted pretty nicely with the orange of the moon and planet.
Mm-hmm. And what about Jupiter? Is that visible right now, too? I thought I read that it was.
Yeah, Jupiter is actually much brighter than Mars, even. And it's pretty high in the western sky after sunset. So if people go out and look, say, at 8:30 in the evening and look high in the west, it'll be the brightest object in the sky, not counting the moon, of course.
Tom from La Crosse said the moon looked really small last night to him. Was that a function of its color?
Actually, I think it's probably more a case of it being high in the sky. And it turns out that when the moon, particularly a full moon, lies near the horizon, it appears a little bit larger than it actually is because we're seeing it relative to objects along the horizon we're familiar with. And as it climbs higher in the sky, it tends to get or tends to appear smaller, even though it's not really. So probably what you are seeing is a combination of it looking small because it was pretty high in the sky, and the fact that it wasn't as bright as a typical full moon, at least during the eclipse, probably made it look a little bit smaller too.
And Rich, we're also expecting a meteor shower later in the month. What are we expecting there?
Yeah, this is a meteor shower called the Lyrid meteor shower, and that's astronomers' name for a meteor shower that appears to come from the constellation Lyra, which is high in the sky in the morning. We're going to have a peak, actually, a week from today, on the morning of April 22nd, is when it's going to be at its best. And the good news is that the moon, which was full last night, is going to be getting less and less lit as we approach the time a week from now. So it won't be in the sky as much and bothering us quite as much.
How spectacular will that be as far as meteor showers go? Is this going to be a good one?
It should be reasonably good. It's not going to be as good as usually the best of the year when you can see up to one meteor per minute sometimes. This one probably will give us about a dozen meteors every hour or so. That's a pretty good rate and much better than what we get on a normal night, but it won't be as spectacular as a couple of them that we get.
Saturn is going to come into view later this spring. Tell us when we can start to see it, and what are some of the best ways to enjoy it? Is it going to be close enough that a standard telescope will allow us to see its rings?
Yeah, if people were out last night and managed to look away from the moon and Mars and Spica a little bit, there was another fairly bright object to the upper left of those objects, and that was the planet Saturn, and it's going to be coming to its peak in the first half of May, so we're talking about a little bit less than a month from now. It's going to be at its brightest, and it is something, surprisingly, that can be seen through a small telescope. Even the smallest telescope will show the rings and give you a nice three-dimensional view of the planet. I think Saturn and the moon, to a lesser extent, are the two objects in the sky that really look like what people expect them to look like if they see them through a telescope.
What else can we look forward to? Sounds like a lot of exciting things just in terms of visibility right now, but what else are you looking forward to?
Oh, there's always stuff going on in the sky. But I would say the other thing that interests me is a little bit more esoteric. But it turns out that there are the two brightest asteroids in the sky, and asteroids are space rocks, basically, that orbit the sun between Mars and Jupiter. The two brightest ones of those are actually at their peak right this week. And although they aren't bright enough to see with the naked eye, unless you're under a very dark sky, they are bright enough to see through binoculars. And the cool thing about them is that they're very close to one another in the sky. In fact, closer than they've been since they were discovered more than 200 years ago. So it's a really spectacular close pairing of these, visible in the same binocular field if you're taking a look at them. And the thing that adds to the excitement is that there's a spacecraft that's actually in between them right now. We had the Dawn spacecraft as a NASA probe that was at the asteroid Vesta and left about a year and a half ago and is now on its way to Ceres, and it'll arrive there early next year. So we've kind of got a small spacecraft that's obviously much too small to see with any optical aid from Earth, but it's in between where the two asteroids are.
Well, Rich, thank you so much for being with us today.
I'm glad I could help.
That's Rich Talcott. He's senior editor at Astronomy Magazine.
There's plenty of talk these days about the affordability of college with rising tuition and record amounts of student debt. There seems to be a growing attitude that maybe the current system isn't working, and that's got a lot of people questioning if college is still worth it.
Our next guest says, yes, college is still worth it, but something needs to change. Her idea? Have the federal government partner with states, public colleges and universities, and localities and businesses to offer the first 2 years of college for free. So how would it work?
Well, joining us now in the studio is Sarah Goldrick-Rabb. She's an associate professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison. She's the co-author of a new report called Redefining College Affordability, Securing America's Future with a Free Two-Year College Option. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So you've written that the current system of financial aid fails to support the American dream. Why?
Well, I think that families across Wisconsin and across the nation believe in the importance of hard work. And they tell themselves that if only their students, their children work hard in school or if they work hard in their workplace and then they seek an education, that that hard work will pay off by enabling them to get a college education. Instead, what's happening is even after all of that hard work of going through high school or going through the workplace on the way to college, once they get there and they file that financial aid form for assistance, what they find out is they are still completely unable to afford it.
And as a result, they're dropping out? They're not finishing?
In fact, they're starting to not attend, which I think is the most troubling evidence. We're finding that among academically well-prepared students, even those from middle-income families are starting to forego college. And it doesn't look like this is happening because they don't want to attend anymore, because the surveys indicate they do want to attend. They just can't afford it. We are also seeing higher rates of dropout.
And I have been doing some reading about this lately, and I understand that in certain cases, colleges may offer financial aid to students who look the best on paper. They have the best test scores instead of the students who have the most need. And this is, I guess, as seen as a way to help colleges improve their ranking. Does that factor into this?
Sure, that's part of it. Although here in Wisconsin, we actually don't give out that much financial assistance only to students who have academic merit and not financial need. There are other states that are far more invested in that sort of strategy. Wisconsin understands that there's talent all over the state, and it does invest in them to the degree that we have the resources to do so.
So right now there has been a lot of criticism, a lot of cultural commentary about whether college is still worth it for people, especially if you look at the debt load that people are carrying, you know, long into their adulthood. So how would you answer that question? Is college still worth it?
I actually don't think that the question of whether college is worth it should be made purely in economic terms. I think it's rather arbitrary that we're deciding whether or not the 13th or 14th grades of education are valuable based on economic returns, and yet you don't hear anyone saying, well, 11th grade is no longer valuable, or 9th grade is no longer valuable. The fact of the matter is that people understand that to participate in their communities, they need to be informed and they need to be educated. And I don't think that people who are college educated are in any way better than anyone else, but I think they've had the luxury of spending more time getting to know about the world. So I believe that college is worth it primarily because people get to continue to the learning process and that that's valuable. And it seems that that's actually what the American public is saying.
And you have a plan to help make this happen and make it easier, you hope, for people to go to college and to finish college. Tell us about your plan.
Well, this is a plan that I developed with Nancy Kendall, my colleague at UW-Madison, and it was initially funded with a grant that allowed us to work on this from the Lumina Foundation. Now, this is really important to remember. This plan does not involve any extra resources. This is not magic money. This is not inventing out of thin air a way to rob institutions of all of their tuition and somehow still educate students. This is about simply taking the existing money that is already in the system at the federal and state levels and changing how we allocate it. So right now, we take a pot of about $100 billion of federal financial aid and we spread it very thinly. We spread it across students who are getting associate's degrees and bachelor's degrees. We also spread it across students no matter what kind of institution they're in. So if you could imagine that in K-12, we took our limited dollars and we spread them across any kind of school you went to, of any sort, you'd find that we actually don't have very much money left for our public schools. And that, in fact, is what's happening in higher education. So we take the existing money and we simply focus it on the public sector, where the vast majority of Americans seem to prefer to go to college, and we focus it on 2 years, because 2 years is a good start.
What is crucial about getting through those first 2 years at a public university?
Well, first of all, the evidence actually indicates very nice and strong returns to a two-year degree. An associate's degree in Wisconsin pays off quite substantially. And nationwide, if you compare the wage offered by a job that requires an associate's degree, it's about $61,000. If you compare that to a job requiring a bachelor's degree, it's about $63,000. Now, some people will argue that's because the bachelor's degree is being devalued. But I'd argue it's actually because the associate's degree is worthwhile. It's also the case that if you're going on for a four-year degree, it's often the experience of students that during those first 2 years, they're sorting things out. They're not yet sure whether they're college material. They're not yet sure whether they can really make it. And if they can't establish momentum during those first 2 years, and yet they carry debt and they take on expenses they're going to have to pay later, and it doesn't work out, that's where we see people really in crisis.
And this is an option, this free 2 years at public universities, for every student, not just students, say, who come from an economically challenged background.
Exactly. And I think that families across Wisconsin would probably recognize that, well, once upon a time, only perhaps the bottom 25% of the income distribution needed financial aid for college. Today, 75% of our families are finding it hard to afford college. So our financial aid system isn't really meeting our needs, and it's leaving a lot of people out in the cold. And they're rightly angry about that. And I think that we have to address it. And the way to address it is to try to lower the costs for anyone who wants to take advantage of it so that they can at least get some security by having 2 years of a college education, rather than try and carry the debt and consider it a lifelong investment that they may never see pay off.
And what if a student has been working hard, they want to go to a private college? Should there still be funding available for them?
Honestly, we say in this report, the answer is no. People have choices, and one of the choices that they legitimately have to make today in higher education is whether they're going to go in the public or private sector. Now, once upon a time, it was the case the public sector didn't have space for you. The public sector was not that large. The public sector had limited options. But if you look around places like Wisconsin, you will see that we offer you small colleges and large colleges. We offer all kinds of experiences in the public sector. And therefore, if you want to choose to go to the private sector, that's something that you and your family can decide to pay for.
And let's say someone takes you up on this. What happens after the first 2 years are up? Who pays for that?
After the first 2 years are up, it's a very good question. Now, under this plan, they would not be allowed, the schools would not be allowed to charge enormous amounts of money after those first 2 years. There would still be loans available to those students because we do not take away the loan dollars at the federal government level in order to do this. And we also retain the work-study program. But there's also the fact that institutions have some of their own financial aid, and I believe that they will find it more worthy to invest that in a student who's already made it through the first 2 years of college and proven themselves.
Is there a concern here at all that by offering 2 free years of higher education that in any way it devalues college? It makes it seem something that's it's less precious.
I think that's a myth that we've told ourselves over the last 20 to 30 years, where colleges have convinced us that the more something costs, the better it is. And that's nonsense. There absolutely is no evidence that a more expensive place is actually a place where you get a better education. It's just a place where you pay more dollars. So just like you can find a bargain vehicle, you can find a bargain education.
Is this anyway going to cement even further a class system where those kids who come from privileged families, they're the ones who can go to Harvard and Yale and Princeton, and somebody else, maybe they have grades that are just as good, they're going to a state school.
Right. I think that the real class system that we have emerging right now is between the people who can get any kind of college completed and those who are just barely entering, losing and dropping out with debt. And that is the biggest most tremendous thing that we need to deal with. You know, I think that we're in a position right now like we were when we were deciding whether or not to expand high school and make that free. A good starting place in this case, rather than jumping in whole hog to making K-12 free, is to start with the equivalent of elementary school the first 2 years. Then we can talk about the bachelor's degree. But at this point in time in this country, with the money that we have and what's available to us and where our families are, I think 2 years is the right place to start.
And any chances that people are going to get through those 2 years and say, well, I've got my 2 years of education, now I'm out of here, I'm going to drop out?
I think, frankly, that wouldn't be dropping out. That would be called jobbing out. That would be called taking a job and going after it with a credential in your hand, and that is a very good outcome.
We're talking right now with Sarah Goldrick-Rabb from UW-Madison. She says it's time to help students make it through college by making the first 2 years free. free at public universities. Well, what do you think of this idea? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. We're talking with Sarah Goldrick-Rabb from UW-Madison right now. She says that in order to make college affordable, it's time to reallocate some resources and offer 2 years of college for free. And what do you think about this idea? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, talking about the idea of making 2 years of college for free at public universities. And we'll go to our first caller now. Jean joins us in Duluth, Iowa. Hi, Jean.
Duluth, Minnesota, actually.
Ah, Duluth, Minnesota. Sorry, I've got a typo there. Yeah. What do you think about this idea?
I'm in favor of it. I would certainly support it here as well as there. I spent a career as a vocational guidance counselor for a special population, but one of my frustrations was that the schools tend to be all too often a hurdle rather than as a conduit to the jobs, because they were trying to meet academic rather than societal standards. By societal, I mean jobs, really. I think this wouldn't be 2 years of schooling free. This would be investing in your society.
Great. Well, thank you for your thoughts, Jean. And what do you think about that, Sarah?
I think that's exactly right. I think that we know that when we get people access to this kind of education, it pays off tremendously in the long run. It really is a matter of spending money now or spending a whole lot more money later.
Well, thank you so much for your thoughts, Gene. And let's move along to Bruce joining us in Partyville. Hi, Bruce.
Hello there. My question is, well, I actually kind of like the plan. We're still using taxpayer dollars somewhere along the way in the old world loans and the new ways through some other mechanism to fund the tuition. How does the plan or the concept help control what is, in effect, rampant tuition inflation?
Okay, good question. Thanks, Bruce. Sarah?
I think that's a terrific question. It's a question that we started with when we were thinking about how to do this. So first of all, we need to know that right now we have absolutely no way of controlling it. And in fact, there's some evidence that financial aid is used to drive up the prices charged at some schools, notably private and especially for-profit institutions. And we're not getting a handle on that. Under this plan, there is a list of allowable expenses that the federal government will dictate to these institutions that says, look, you can provide an education to students in the following categories, and that's what we're willing to pay for. It also says that it is not okay to charge, or not to charge, but to spend an incredible amount more at your school than some neighboring school is able to do, so that geography will no longer so closely dictate the quality of the local public school near you. So it has a variety of mechanisms built in here, and I agree with you, the taxpayers are spending a lot. In this case, the effort here is to get a handle on that inflation, to get some control over it.
Okay, well, thank you for the thought. And we'll move along. Sue is joining us. She's in Minocqua. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I think that your heart is in the right place on this, but my concern is that the majority of kids I knew when I was in college that had a free ride, and what I'm seeing from my children's classmates who have a free ride, they, I can't say across the board everyone, but a fairly high majority doesn't seem to appreciate that. They don't apply themselves, and they don't really make use of the opportunity. So rather than offering a free education the first 2 years, I could see doing a highly subsidized, but if that kid doesn't have a vested interest, if they aren't paying something, they aren't necessarily going to work very hard.
All right. Well, thank you, Sue, for that. And this getting at that question again about whether this idea would devalue college, you do allow for a work aspect of it as well.
Yeah, that's right. So I certainly have heard people say what you're saying, Sue, and I understand where it's coming from. We're worried about students not being sufficiently motivated. But what's important to know is that when we've gone out in the field and done research on this topic, we find very little evidence that students aren't motivated. What looks like lack of motivation is, in fact, for many of these students, the effect of trying to do too much. And they end up slacking in school because they're spending so much time outside of school working, doing childcare, helping their families, etc. And they end up looking like they're not doing much at school. We find that they actually appear to be more motivated when they actually are more financially supported. So the research evidence would actually indicate that we'd see higher levels of academic performance under this plan.
Okay, well, thank you for calling, Sue. And let's go next. Mike is joining us in Allentown. I think that's right. Yes. Hello, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Good. Kind of along the same lines, rather than the first 2 years, why not the last 2 years? I mean, that's when students are most money-strapped. Kind of the same reason as the last caller is that, you know, when I was in college, there were a lot of people there that were just occupying space and not, you know, really caring about it. I think as you get into the last 2 years of college, when you're really money strapped and you have the goal at the end in sight, would be a better way to spend that money.
Okay, that's an interesting thought, Mike. So maybe that would help people get to the finish line of a four-year degree anyway if the last 2 years were paid for. What about that?
Right. Well, I certainly understand where you're coming from, and you're right. The current system often leaves those students who are in the home stretch short of the cash that they need to finish, and that's really unfortunate. In this case, I believe that that would primarily advantage those on their way to the bachelor's degree and would leave out in the cold those people who are really at the most economic risk in this society, and those are people who are not going to be going for four-year degrees. They need those two-year degrees. And so, in other words, I don't think it would be the best economic or most cost-effective use of our resources to focus them on the last 2 years of a bachelor's degree.
We're talking right now with Sarah Goldrick Rabb. She is with UW-Madison. She's got an idea, a plan to make college more affordable, and it is to make the first 2 years of college free at public universities by reallocating resources that are already available, funding that's already there, making the first 2 years of public colleges, universities, technical schools free. And we'll go back to the phones right now. You can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And Eugene joins us next from Viola. Hey, Eugene.
Good afternoon. The free college isn't anything new. I went 2 years to normal school, Normal County Teachers College. You picked up 68 credits, cost you $48 for 2 years tuition. You picked up 68 credits, 64 transferred to a state college, and it cost you $48.
All right.
It's a dollar bill.
So a similar idea there that he's seen. You want to respond to that?
I think that's right, and I actually think that I'm looking to history here and thinking about this idea. I will say this. The plan that Nancy and I have put forward does not simply involve a waiver of the cost of tuition and fees, but it actually also provides a way for people to meet their living expenses, you know, admittedly just above poverty level. I mean, we're not trying to allow people to, you know, live high on the hog while they're going to school, but it does the equivalent of what you might recall the GI Bill of 1944 did, which is it provides a subsistence payment. It's a limited amount, and they work for part of it, but it allows them to focus on school. And one of the reasons that so many students, especially in our technical colleges right now, struggle to get done in timely fashion is how much they are juggling school and work.
Sarah, if nothing new happens, if your plan isn't adopted, if the way the college payment process goes on the way it has right now, what's at stake here?
I think there's a lot at stake here. I mean, frankly, what we're seeing happen right now is a lot of people go to college. They want to do that. They're accruing quite a bit of debt. They're leaving without a degree in their hands, and they're walking away pretty angry. I think that's a dangerous situation for this country to be in. It's not a good thing for people to have worked hard and seen it not pay off.
And so you think that by getting more people into college and helping them, we'll see people reinvested in college again?
Well, I don't even know that we'll see so many more people go to college. I think we'll get a few more people going. But the main point here is to increase the efficiency. It's to get people who start college to actually finish with something in their hands so that they can walk away and move into the labor market and not be angry at our government and feel that they've been supported in their effort to live the American dream.
You're a professor of educational policy at UW-Madison. You're on campus. You're with students. What do you hear from them about their experience and their experience with college and the debt load and all of that right now?
Right. I have to say, I mean, I am at Madison, but I spend a lot of my time on our other campuses. Just the other day, I was out at Platteville. I've been out at Richland Center and at Stout. I've also been all over the country at a lot of two-year schools. And what I hear are a lot of very frustrated, concerned people who wonder why it is that we're not supporting them in doing something that everybody widely says is a good idea.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Sarah Goldrick Rabb, an associate professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison. She's the co-author of a new report called Redefining College Affordability, just out today.
Today is April 15th, and we all know what that means. It's tax day. We hope it's been a smooth tax season for you.
What you may not know is that April 15th also marks the first day that Wisconsinites can circulate nomination papers for fall elections.
That means if you want to run for a public office in November, today is the day to get on it.
Maybe running for office is something you dream about, but you don't really know where to start. Well, to help you on your quest, we have someone here to help explain the process.
For today's Teach Me What You Know segment, Michael Haas joins us. He's Elections Division Administrator at the Wisconsin Government Accountability Board. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, before we get started, when we talk about running for public office, what does that mean? What kinds of public office should we start to think about?
Well, the election this fall is for statewide offices, as well as the legislature, and there are three county offices up, the sheriff, coroner, and the clerk of circuit court for each county will be on the ballot, as well as there will be a referendum on a constitutional amendment, but those are the offices that will be up. Approximately 350 different offices around the state will be on the ballot.
And draw a distinction for us just a little bit. What is the role of the Government Accountability Board in that process, and how far down do you go in terms of locality?
Our agency administers and enforces election laws. We are the filing officer for state and federal candidates. Candidates at the local level, including the county offices we just mentioned, their filing officer is the county clerk. So they will file all their paperwork with the county clerk. State and federal candidates will file their paperwork with our office.
When one makes a decision about whether or not to run, what types of things should someone consider?
Well, it's a very personal decision, and I think our agency really has to recognize and give a tip of the hat to all candidates. It's a personal decision. It involves a commitment of energy, time, resources, money. It can take a toll on your personal life to be in the arena, but we need people to step up, raise their hand, and make that commitment. It's what makes a democracy go. I think the easiest or shortest way to put the preparation would be to make sure you're qualified to be a candidate, and then make sure you qualify. In other words, make sure that to be qualified, you need to be a citizen, 18 years old, not a convicted felon. And generally, there are some residence requirements as well for most offices.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's say I do meet these criteria. What's my first step?
There are four basic documents that a candidate needs to file if they're going to run for office in Wisconsin. First, there's a campaign committee registration statement, and that's the form that documents what your campaign committee is, your treasurer, what your bank account will be. And that's the basis of campaign finance reporting requirements in the state of Wisconsin. The second document, then, are the nomination papers that are circulated to have people sign to support the candidate or to support him in the candidate's name on the ballot. Third, we have a declaration of candidacy form that needs to be submitted with the filing officer. And then fourth, state candidates need to file a statement of economic interest, and some local candidates will as well. So those are the four basic documents.
Okay. Let's break these down just a little bit. First of all, how many signatures do I need?
It depends which office you're running for. Statewide offices, which will be on the ballot, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, state treasurer, secretary of state, those offices need a minimum of 2,000 signatures. Congressional candidates need at least 1,000 signatures. State Senate candidates need 400. State Assembly candidates need 200. And then county offices need a minimum of either 200 or 500 signatures, depending on if they are in a county that is more than 100,000 population.
As a citizen, just to step aside just a little bit, if someone approaches me and says, "Will you sign my nomination form?" If I do, am I obligated then to vote for that person?
No, absolutely not. And the nomination paper, the only purpose of that is to demonstrate some level of support, simply to have the candidate's name on the ballot.
But how many candidates in one race should I sign for?
You can only sign for one. If somebody signs for more than one candidate for the same office, the second signature will be struck and will not be counted towards that candidate's nomination papers. Mm.
Going to the statement of economic interest, what is on that statement? What types of things is a candidate declaring when they submit that?
That is basic financial information in a general sense. I would note there's a new requirement for the nomination papers that just went into effect due to recent legislation that was passed and signed by the governor. This year, for the first time, signers will also need to print their name in a legible manner, otherwise their signature will not be counted. So that's an important note for candidates to remember on their nomination papers. For the Statement of Economic Interest, that is a form that is filed with our office. It records a candidate or a public officer's general financial interests, categories of investments in a monetary range, not a specific dollar amount, but investments they have, property they own, business interests that they may have. And that's a requirement for candidates to be on the ballot at the state level and in some counties.
When it comes to submitting these forms, how is it done? Is there an online way to do that, or is it all still the old-fashioned way on paper?
Well, a little bit of both. For the most part, we need original paperwork. The nomination papers all have to be original nomination papers. The campaign registration form, it can be initiated online through our campaign finance information system website, but then we also will need the original signature, the original documents. The Statement of Economic Interest and the Declaration of Candidacy, we also need original documents.
If we're, you know, if we're still thinking about it, we're not quite sure we want to run for office, when is it too late to get started on a campaign?
I guess that depends on the office and the candidates and the supporters. This is the official kickoff from a legal perspective of the campaign season, but of course candidates may have been raising money for months for some races. And if you want to be on the ballot, though, it is definitely too late after June 2nd. That's the deadline for nomination papers to be filed. You could be a write-in candidate after that, but if you want to be on the ballot, all the paperwork needs to be in by June 2nd, with the exception of the Statement of Economic Interest. That would be due on June 5th, the following Thursday.
And when are the primaries?
The primary this year is August 12th, and the general election is on November 4th.
Mm-hmm. Is there an estimate of how much time you need to devote to getting yourself on the ballot?
Well, again, I think that depends on the office. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of candidates look at the nomination paper process as an excellent way to get out and meet voters. You're asking them for a simple thing, just simply to sign nomination papers, and that can be done door-to-door or at a farmer's market or any other public event where you might see a lot of people. There are some candidates, depending on the office, that might spend their entire summer, you know, knocking on doors, and 10 or 20,000 doors. But then you also have other campaign tactics, obviously, you know, media advertising and other public events. And so I think the intensity of the time commitment depends largely on the office you're running for, obviously, if you have any opposition, and the individual candidate's choice of what tactics they want to take.
Do they have to be present for every signature that they collect, or can they send, you know, delegates out there for themselves?
Absolutely. That's a good point. The candidate does not have to collect every single signature. Most of the larger campaigns will use it as a way to help organize their supporters and have their supporters go out and collect signatures for them.
Now, it seems as though, I mean, obviously the Government Accountability Board is a resource for prospective candidates to understand how they should get their name on the ballot and vie for a public office in a valid way. Do you also serve as a resource for things like timeline and planning and I imagine not campaign strategy, but to the extent that you might help them with these milestones along the way in terms of the dates?
Sure, absolutely. For state candidates, especially, we're considered to be a one-stop shop for filing their paperwork. And we have an excellent staff that helps candidates with any questions about their campaign finance reports or what the rules are for campaign contributions or nomination papers. And we encourage candidates to call our office. We have a lot of information on our website, which is gab.wi.gov, and people can feel free to look at that website, call our staff. Candidates for county office may be better off first calling their county clerk, because they may have more direct information related to that office.
Mm-hmm. One thing that seems like an elephant in the room here when it comes to elections is money. Money plays a role, maybe not so much in getting your name on the ballot, but certainly what happens after that and the ability to win. But does it cost anything to get started in the process, to at least get your name on the ballot?
Well, at a minimum, you would need to print or copy things like nomination papers and forms that have to be filled out. There's no rule saying you have to raise a certain amount of money. We no longer have a public campaign finance law in the state that people can candidates could take advantage of. We have, obviously, contribution limits that all candidates need to abide by depending on the office. I think most candidates would tell you the more money they have in the bank, the more flexibility they have to reach out to voters. And in the modern campaign world seems to be an advantage. There are a lot of offices, particularly at the local level, where good old effort and door-to-door and grassroots politicking can be very effective.
Mm-hmm. Any other pointers you want to offer here in our final moments?
I think specifically we want people to be aware of the new requirement to have a printed name for each signature on nomination papers. And then again, we would encourage everybody to go to our website as a resource. Some county clerks also have very good websites with a lot of information. And speaking of local clerks, we want to also thank them. They just came through a spring election with 3,500 offices on the ballot and the poll workers, and we're going to be asking them to turn around and get ready for the fall election with a lot of new election laws.
And it's been a busy couple of years for you with all those recalls coming along the way, too, in Wisconsin. So, Michael, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
That was Michael Haas. He is the Elections Division Administrator at the Wisconsin Government Accountability Board.